It was a lot to think about. Jib had made casual reference to the divided passions over the war in his county, but in mentioning his father's death, he had simply stated that it was in a saloon fight. Keeping Porter's advice in mind, especially his comments on the 08 brand, Tanner rode down to the end of the street to the jail. As the owner of the stable had said, the jail was little more than a log cabin with a sign over the door that read, Sheriff. There were no horses tied out front, and when he pulled up at the steps, he saw that there was a padlock on the door. Tanner dismounted and looped Ash's reins over the hitching post. There was a window on the side of the cabin, so he walked around the building to look inside. Peering through the iron bars, he saw a small room with a desk and a single chair, evidently the sheriff's office. At the rear of the building, there was a closed door that apparently led to the cells. Moving to the rear of the building, he found a second window. This one smaller and a few feet higher than the one on the side. Looking around for something to stand on, he could find nothing in the way of a bucket, a box, or even a log. So he went back for ashes. Looking up and down the street, he saw no one but a couple of men passing the time of day in front of a saloon about 50 yards away. They seemed to be paying him no mind, so he climbed in the saddle and rode around to the rear of the jail. Seated in the saddle, he could easily see in the tiny window.
Jeb! You in there?
Tanner! Is that you?
Yeah, it's me. Where the hell are you?
I'm right here.
Jeb stood up on the bunk that was right under the window. The bed was close against the wall, which was the reason Tanner had not seen it from outside. Jeb's smiling face appeared up next to the bars.
I swear I never thought I'd see you again. What the hell are you doing here? Did you just get run out of Virginia?
I came looking for you. I was hoping I'd catch up with you before you set off for the gold fields in Montana. Looks like there was no need to hurry. What the hell you do to get thrown in jail?
Got drunk. That was what I suppose started it all.
But hell, Tanner, I wasn't looking for no trouble. Matter of fact, I was just feeling like I was everybody's friend until that son of a bitch behind the bar said something about my paw. Said I was fixing to end up like he did or something like that. I don't remember exactly what he said. I was drunk. Anyway, Jeff Yates, he's the sheriff. He said I broke a whiskey bottle over the bartender's head. I reckon I did. I don't remember. Yates sneaked up behind me and hit me upside the head with a gun butt and dragged my ass in here. That's how I got here. Ain't that a fine way to treat a hero home from the war?
Jeb, that fella Porter over the stables told me they were trying to charge you as a horse thief because of that sorrel you borrowed from the Union Army.
I heard about that. Hell, I told them I bought that horse at an army auction. Same as you, if they ask you.
Didn't do you much good.
No, I reckon it didn't, did it? But I still don't understand what you're doing here. I thought you was going home to get hitched. What happened? Did you bring her with you? Or did she meet another feller?
Yeah, my brother.
Oh, Tanner, I don't know what to say.
Couldn't be helped. They thought I was dead.
Tanner went on to tell Jeb the story of his homecoming.
I'll be damned. There's a bright side to it, though. Now we can go to Montana and find us a fortune, get us enough money to buy a couple of the high-class wives. Hell, we might turn Mormon and have a couple wives apiece.
There's not but one small detail that needs to be worked out. You're in jail.
Oh, hell. They ain't gonna keep me here long. It'd cost too much to feed me. I probably would have done been out if it was anybody but me. Old Jeff Yates don't like me much. He didn't like my old man, so I reckon it was natural he wanted to throw me in jail for a spell. That horse stealing talk is just that. Talk. Trying to throw a scare into me.
Maybe so. Hope you're right. That fella Porter thought they might be serious about it. I'll go back and see if I can sleep in the stable for a couple of days till they let you out of here. Maybe I can find the sheriff and get some idea from him. Is he ever in the office?
Not much of the time. He's got a farm like everybody else in this town, so he just padlocks the door and drops by whenever he feels like it. The good part of it is, I don't have to see his ugly face but now and then. Annie Watley from over to the saloon brings me two meals a day. So I haven't been suffering none. Besides, I knew you'd come rescue me.
10er left the jail with the hope that he might find out more regarding the length of Jeb's stay in the crude jail. Jeb advised him to steer clear of Jeff Yates. He further advised him not to let on that he was Jeb's friend. 10er figured the best place to get information was the saloon. So after making arrangements with Mr. Porter to sleep in the stall with Ashes, he walked down the street to the Statesman. The evening crowd of patrons had already begun to gather in the dimly lit saloon. Off to one side and a few paces from the door, there was a table with a sign requesting that saloon patrons leave all their weapons there. A few men stood at the bar exchanging conversation over their beer mugs. It was not a large room, but big enough to crowd in four tables beyond the bar. On this evening, only the table in the back corner seemed to be occupied. But there was a group of seven men gathered around it, having borrowed chairs from the vacant tables. 10er figured that the table no doubt represented the saloon's regulars. He paused at the weapons table to leave a Spencer carbine before proceeding to the bar.
Howdy, mister.
The bartender was a stocky man, sporting a handlebar mustache and wearing a bandana around his head.
What'll it be?
Of two shots of your best whiskey.
The bartender looked 10er over while he poured from a bottle taken from beneath the counter.
Ain't seen you in here before. Just get into town?
Yep, just passing through.
10er placed the empty shot glass back on the bar. He carried the shot over to the empty table next to the one in the corner. He pulled up one of the few empty chairs and sat down facing the occupied table. His plan was to strike up a conversation with one of the locals and possibly guide it toward the prisoner in the jail. He cautioned himself to avoid being too obvious and seeking information, though. As it turned out, he found out what he wanted to know without having to question anyone. Jeb became the general topic of conversation at the crowded table when another man joined the group. Pulling up a chair, the newcomer squeezed in between two others at the table. From the round of greetings the man received, 10er gathered that he had been away from town for a while. After acknowledging the greetings, he leveled a question at a heavyset man with a dark beard and eyes buried deep beneath a brooding forehead.
So, Jeff, I hear you got old Zach Hawkins' boy locked up in the jail.
That's a fact.
I expect there's folks around here that was hoping he wouldn't make it back from the war. I swear, I don't know why that boy would want to come back to Mound City. Yeah, probably just to spite us.
Well, it didn't do him a hell of a lot of good, did it? Just to come back here to get himself hung.
What did he do to get himself hung?
Oh, we're done talking about it. Judge Harris is fixing the rule on it tomorrow. I expect we'll have a hanging next day after that.
Seated at the next table, 10er slowly sipped his drink. He had heard all he needed to hear. The sheriff sounded pretty confident about what the judge's ruling would be. They were gonna railroad Jeb. It wasn't a prosecution of a crime. It was simple extermination that the good folk of Mound City had in mind. 10er had heard stories, some from Jeb, about the Kansas-Missouri border wars between the free soilers and the pro-slavers that led up to the war just ended. According to Jeb, there were plenty of folks in Mound City who held Southern sympathies. Sitting in the saloon now, 10er wondered where those people were and if they were apt to come out and support a one who'd fought for the Confederacy. The sheriff certainly was confident that Jeb's trial was merely a formality before the hanging. It was pretty clear to 10er what he had to do. Tossing back the last few drops of the strong whiskey, he placed the empty glass on the table and stood up. When he did, he found the sheriff's gaze focused upon him. 10er looked at the fleshy brute of a man for a few long seconds before turning and slowly walking toward the door. The sheriff rose. 10er walked toward the table where the weapons were deposited.
Hold on there a minute, mister.
Tanner casually reached down and picked up his rifle before turning slowly to face the sheriff. Yates halted a couple of steps from Tanner and looked him up and down before speaking again.
I'm the sheriff in this town, and I'd like to know what business strangers like you have in Mound City.
I don't have any business in Mound City. I'm just passing through. I ain't broke any laws, have I?
Why, none that you've been caught at yet. We've been seeing a fair number of drifters coming through here since the war, and that ain't what the folks here want to see. You fighting the war?
Maybe.
If I was to guess, I'd say it wasn't on the Union side.
Tanner answered with a smile.
I thought so. I don't believe you Rebs were issued Spencer carbines. I might have to order you to hand that over. That's government property.
I took this rifle off a dead man. The next man that gets it is going to have to take it the same way.
Yates was not expecting the defiance he encountered. His eyes locked on Tanner's, measuring the depth of the stranger's resolve. Something he saw there told him that there was cold steel behind the gaze.
Mister, you're fixing to make the biggest mistake of your life. Now hand that rifle to me butt first.
Tanner brought the Spencer up chest high.
Sheriff, I ain't broken no laws in your town. But if your hand comes up with that pistol in it, you're a dead man.
Are you that big a fool? Threatening a lawman?
Tanner made no reply, simply staring coldly into the sheriff's eyes.
Look around you. You're outnumbered 7-1. You pull that trigger and there'll be half a dozen on you before you can cock that rifle again.
I reckon there'd be only two dead then. And one of them's gonna be you. So it's your call. I walk out of here and no harm done. Or you and I can catch the evening train to hell together.
I've got him covered, Jeff.
The bartender pulled a double-barreled shotgun from under the counter.
My finger's getting awfully damn itchy. If that shotgun goes off, you're a dead man. Tell him to put the gun away and I'll not waste any time riding out of your friendly little town.
Put it away, Lonnie.
When the bartender lowered the shotgun, Yates turned back to Tanner.
All right, I'm gonna let you go so these innocent bystanders don't get hurt. But I want you out of my town, and I don't mean maybe. I ain't likely to be in such a good mood next time I see you.
Reach across with your left hand and lift that pistol out of the holster. Real slow.
Do it, damn it!
He did it.
All right, drop it on the floor and kick it over here.
Tanner stooped to pick up the weapon, being careful to keep the rifle trained on the sheriff. Backing slowly toward the door, Tanner watched the crowd of uneasy citizens of Mound City carefully, lest anyone try to make a run for the weapons table. But none was heroic to the extent of testing the tall stranger. Tanner paused in the doorway for a moment. Then he suddenly stepped outside, slammed the door, and jammed the sheriff's pistol barrel through the door handle, wedging it against the door frame. It wouldn't hold for long, but it might delay the pursuit enough to let him get a head start. Running as fast as he could, he darted between the saloon and the dry goods store. Turning the corner, he sprinted along behind the buildings, heading for the stable. John Porter was startled when Tanner suddenly appeared at the back of the stable at a dead run.
What the?
Tanner rushed by him, going straight to the tack room where his saddle was stored. In a moment, he reappeared with the saddle on his shoulder.
I reckon I won't be staying the night after all. How much I owe you?
Nothing.
Tanner slipped the bit in Ash's mouth and pulled the bridle on.
You paid me for the oats.
He stood gaping as Tanner threw the saddle on the big gray horse.
You sure seem to be in one hell of a hurry. Is somebody after you?
I don't know, but I expect it's a possibility.
The big gray drove for a bend in the road that would take him out of sight of the building. Lying low on Ash's neck, Tanner waited for the snap of bullets to overtake him, but there were none. And soon he gained the shield of a grove of hardwoods at a curve in the road. Riding on, he eased up on the gray a bit as he quickly looked about him for the best place to leave the road. Knowing he didn't have much time to decide, he took the easiest route of escape. Pulling hard on the reins, he swung the gray to his left, jumped a shallow ditch, followed a faint drainage trail down through a stand of hickories and oaks. Weaving between dark trunks, he made his way through the trees until coming to a creek bordered by chokecherry thickets and buckthorn. Tanner couldn't see the road, but from the sound, he knew that they had continued on, evidently failing to see where he had plunged into the trees, thankfully. This, he decided, was as good a place as any to wait out the remaining daylight. The sheriff had to figure that he had fled the town, anxious to put Mound City far behind him. So Tanner reasoned that the lawman would not think to search for him close to town. The problem to be solved now was how to get Jeb out of jail. While he pictured the tiny jail in his mind and tried to think of his best chance for breaking Jeb out, he took a look around the woods he had picked as his hiding place. Leaving ashes to graze by the creek, he pushed through a thicket on the other side to discover a clear field of perhaps 5 or 6 acres. At the far end of the field, a small farmhouse sat between 2 sizable oak trees. Tanner stood in the cover of the thicket for a while, watching to see if there was any activity around the house. Seeing none, he felt reasonably safe in assuming there would be no one venturing across the field in his direction. He returned to the creek to wait out the daylight. A little before dusk, he heard the sheriff's posse returning to town. He settled back and waited. Finally, darkness settled in around the chokecherry bushes, and Tanner determined it was time to act. The fact that he was about to embark on his first ever act that was against the law never entered his mind. As far as he was concerned, he was planning to free a comrade in arms from an enemy prison. It was a matter of right or wrong, and he would not leave Jeb there to be hung.
Your supper's a mite cold.
Jeff Yates pushed the door open with his foot.
I wasn't here to unlock the door for Annie, so she had to leave it on the stoop. She put a cloth over it, but flies got to it anyway. I sure feel bad about that, but I had to chase one of your Reb friends out of town.
Yates slid the plate under the bars, knocking a biscuit off on the floor.
That little dirt won't hurt you.
Why, Sheriff, I'm just about overcome with gratitude. I wouldn't have expected you back at all tonight after such a hard day of sitting on your ass in the saddle.
Hey, you've always had a sassy mouth on you, ain't you? We'll see how sassy you can talk day after tomorrow when I hang your sorry ass.
Hang me for what? Disturbing the peace?
Horse thieving?
I ain't stole no horse!
Then Jeb's eyes opened wide and a broad smile formed on his face. Puzzled by Jeb's sudden transformation, as if he had just heard good news, Yates stared dumbly at his prisoner for a few moments. Then, realizing that Jeb was looking at something behind him, he turned to find himself staring into the muzzle of a Spencer rifle. His hand immediately fell to rest on the handle of his pistol.
It would be a mistake.
Howdy, partner. I reckon it must be time for me to get out of here. Just when I was beginning to feel right at home.
I knew you wasn't just passing through. By God, you're gonna end up at the bottom of a rope for this.
Maybe.
Tanner reached over to relieve the sheriff of his pistol for the second time in one day.
I expect you best take that key ring off your belt, too.
With a look that would scorch a frightened man, the sheriff complied, taking the ring off and tossing it on the floor.
Pick it up.
You pick it up. You gonna shoot me if I don't? I don't think you got the guts to shoot me.
Without hesitating, Tanner lowered the muzzle of the rifle.
Ah! Jesus, my foot! You shot me, you son of a bitch!
I know. If you don't pick up those keys and unlock that cell, I'm gonna shoot the other foot.
He aimed the rifle at the sheriff's other foot.
Hold on, damn it! Wait a minute! I'm getting them!
Unable to maintain his balance on one foot, he dropped to the floor and crawled over to retrieve the keys. On hands and knees, he moved to the cell door and began to fumble with the lock.
Come on in, Sheriff.
When Yates balked at entering the jail cell, Tanner administered a heavy boot to his backside, providing just the proper motivation.
We ain't got all night. Come on, Jeb. We best get on over the border to Missouri.
Jeb tossed the keys through the open door to the office.
They're right there whenever you're ready to get out. And you can have the rest of my supper. It's right there on the floor where you left it. I don't expect anybody will be coming around to bother you tonight. That tick on the bunk could use a little more straw, but I managed to sleep on it.
You two are gonna be hanging from the same tree. I'll be out of here in no time, and I'll be coming after you.
It'll be a waste of time, Sheriff. We'll be in Missouri before morning. You got no jurisdiction there.
You think that'll stop me? I'll run you bastards down. You ain't getting away with this. Help! Help! Somebody help!
Tanner said nothing as he solemnly gazed at the wounded lawman. After a moment, he raised his rifle again and sighted through the bar.
Oh, God! I'm gonna kill you!
He shot him in the other foot. Outside, Jeb discovered his horse saddled and waiting beside Tanner's. Tanner told him that the owner of the stable had saddled the horse himself.
Damn, you've been right busy, ain't you? You sure as hell ruined a good pair of boots back there, though. I knew there must have been a reason my pa thought John Porter was a good man. We're gonna cross the Missouri border before morning, we'd best get going.
What the hell you wanna go to Missouri for? Hell, I wanna see Montana.
You said in that... Oh, you just said that for Yates's ears, so he'll head in the wrong direction.
If he's dumb enough.
He's dumb enough. I reckon they'll be calling him old Leadfoot now. Let's go to Montana. But wait, there's one more thing I gotta do before we leave.
With no explanation beyond that, he kicked the sorrel into a gallop heading for the back of the building, leaving Tanner no choice but to follow. The two fugitives raced along behind the buildings until Jeb pulled his horse to a sliding stop behind the saloon. Leaping from the saddle, he burst through the kitchen door to totally stun a Chinese cook and a flabbergasted Annie Watley. Sweeping Annie off her feet, he planted a kiss on her mouth. With her feet on the floor again, she staggered back a couple of steps before gaining her balance.
You crazy son of a bitch!
I know. I said I was gonna marry you when I got out of jail, but I'm afraid I'll have to disappoint you. Bye!
Suddenly, as he had arrived, he was out the back door again and in the saddle. Yeah! Baffled as Annie and the cook were, Tanner hesitated a moment when the woman appeared on the back step. Jeb skedaddled.
You crazy son of a bitch! I've already got a husband!
Wasting no time to attempt to explain his friend's actions, Tanner tipped his hat.
Good evening to you, ma'am. Yeah!
They left Mound City behind, Jeb leading the way. Before striking out toward the northwest, however, Jeb had to make one more stop. They doubled back south of the town, where Jeb led him up through hills thick with sugar maples to an abandoned shack nestled close beside a busy stream.
Home sweet home. This is where my pap and me was living before they shot him. I gotta get my things.
Tanner dismounted and followed him inside. It struck him as little wonder that Jeb had chosen to ride off to join the army. There was nothing left to suggest that anyone had ever lived there. Only a table, a couple of chairs, and a small pot-bellied stove. While Tanner watched, Jeb rolled up a blanket that had been spread for a bed, grabbed a haversack containing some extra clothes and his razor, then turned to face Tanner.
One more thing, and then we best get out of here. If old Leadfoot gets out, this'll be the first place he'll look.
Jeb kicked the little stove over on its side. Then he immediately removed several stones from the base the stove had rested upon, revealing a heavy canvas sack. He took a quick look inside to make sure of the contents before giving Tanner a wide grin.
I wasn't about to leave without this. This'll take us to Montana. A few years back, my pap rode with a gang that held up a Yankee paymaster's wagon. This sack of gold was hid under the wagon seat. Pap couldn't spend it without everybody around here knowing where it came from. So I reckon the Union Army is paying our way to Montana. I told you back in Virginia I had something hid back for a grub stake. I bet you thought I was lying.
It crossed my mind.
By God, you was talking a hell of a lot bigger last night when you was soaking up most of my liquor. Maybe that's just the liquor talking.
Garth Leach glared down at the nervous young man in the army uniform, his eyes threatening. Private Benjamin H. Wilkes glanced around him cautiously, as if afraid someone might see him talking to the dark hulk of a man. He was already regretting the contract he had made with the brooding bully and his three brothers the night before over a bottle in the saloon. What he had bragged about was not totally untrue. He did, in fact, have access to cases of old surplus Springfield rifles. Assigned to the quartermaster section that was responsible for warehousing the surplus weapons until they could be reissued or auctioned off, he had boasted about how easily he could short the inventory.
I ain't saying I can't do it. I'm just saying I have to be careful. It could be my ass if I get caught.
It's damn sure gonna be your ass if I don't get them rifles we agreed on last night.
We don't cotton much to men who can't back up their talk.
Standing behind his brother, Ike stepped up to look Wilkes in the eye. The frightened soldier looked anxiously from one menacing brother to the other, wishing to hell he had never accepted their offer of a drink the night before.
I'm gonna pull a wagon up to that back door tonight at midnight, right after the guard makes his circle around the building. Now we load up them rifles in no time and be gone. You'll be $100 richer, just like I promised. Now, if that back door ain't open, and you ain't there, the army's gonna be less one soldier boy.
I wasn't saying I wasn't gonna be there. I'll be there, all right. A deal's a deal.
Wilkes glanced at Ike, who was grinning then. In contrast to Garth's imposing size, his brother was tall and razor thin, but no less intimidating with his evil gaze.
Yes, sir, I'll be there, just like I said.
A few minutes before midnight, a team of mules pulled an empty wagon slowly along a back alley that separated the quartermaster warehouse from the main armory, stopping the wagon short under the branches of two old hickory trees that screened him from the back door of the warehouse. The five occupants sat quietly while waiting for the guard to walk his post past the building.
Hold them mules still!
Garth's brother Jesse was driving the wagon. He was the third of the Leach brothers, after Garth and Ike. He had inherited much of Garth's bulk and size, but had traded him for a shortage in mental capacity.
Joe! Hop down off that wagon and go see where the damn guard is.
Joe, the youngest of the clan, hesitated for a moment to look at the young girl sitting in the back of the wagon at his side. When Garth looked around to see why Joe hadn't obeyed, Joe quickly got off the wagon.
I'm going.
He turned to the girl.
Now don't you move till I get back.
Jesse smiled a lecherous grin.
Ain't nobody gonna mess with your little wife. At least not with no more time to diddle than we got right now.
Why didn't you leave Cora back there with the other wagons and the horses?
Well, he's afraid she run off on him, that's why. Ain't that right, Joe?
Joe turned to direct his reply to the frightened young girl huddled against the side of the wagon.
She knows I'd come after her if she did. I'm going now.
In a short time, Joe returned to report.
He's on the other side of the building right now, fixing to come around the back.
All right. Everybody be quiet.
From the deep shadows of the hickory trees, they watched as the sentinel plodded slowly around the corner of the warehouse. Moving along the back of the building, he paused momentarily to try the back door to make sure it was locked. Then proceeded unhurriedly on to disappear around the opposite corner.
Let's go. Pull the wagon up to the door. Ike, you go around that corner. Joe, you go around the other. Sing out if you see anybody coming. Now me and Jesse can load the rifles. Cora, when we get the door, you get up there and hold them mules.
Before the wagon came to a complete stop, Garth had already dropped to the ground. Garth tapped on the door and waited for a response. He heard nothing from inside right away, and his anger flared. He was just about to kick the door when it opened to reveal a thoroughly frightened Private Wilkes.
I see you ain't lost your good sense.
Have you got my money?
Oh, I sure got your money. We'll load up them rifles first before we worry about your money.
How do I know you'll pay me? I'm taking one hell of a chance here.
You're wasting my time.
He reached out and with one hand shoved Wilkes aside.
Is that down?
There was a flat cart loaded with wooden crates.
Jesse, pull that cart up to the door and start loading. Wilkes, get me a crowbar or something. I want to see if them rifles in them crates.
I ain't got no crowbar. I ain't crazy enough to cheat you. They're rifles, all right, and you ain't got but 20 minutes before the guard makes another turn around the building.
All right. Well, go ahead and load them, but, friend, there better be Springfield rifles in them boxes. Nobody cheats Garth Leach and lives to talk about it.
In less than 15 minutes, they'd loaded all the rifles on the cart.
We got room for a couple of more crates.
Wilkes was about to protest, but he was saved the effort when Joe ran back.
Sentry's turning the far corner of the building next to the warehouse.
All right, let's get out of here. We'll pick Ike up at the corner.
Well, what about my money?
Hurry up, pull on out, I'll catch up. Step inside the door and I'll pay you.
Well, hurry. He's gonna be here any minute.
You don't have to worry about that. Here's your pay.
Wilkes reached out for his money, but the object Garth pulled from behind him was a 10-inch hunting knife. Then, just to make sure he was dead, he sliced Wilkes' throat open. His business finished, he left the warehouse, closing the door behind him, and trotted unhurriedly toward the wagon waiting at the corner of the building.
I don't reckon we'll be doing no more business with Private Wilkes.
Ike was looking at the knife still in his older brother's hand.
Let's get out of here. There ain't no chance he'll tell anybody who's got the guns.
Well, he most likely wouldn't have told anybody he sold the guns, and we might have got some more from him. I just hope the guard don't try the door again. We might have somebody hot on our trail.
I killed him because I didn't like the son of a bitch. We ain't likely to be back in this part of the country anyway.
Well, old Yellow Calf can quit his moaning about wanting guns for his Kiowas now. Got enough rifles in this wagon for half his band and whiskey enough so the other half won't care.
That's a fact.
When them soldiers find old Wilkes back there, suspect they're missing some rifles, they're gonna be looking out for them. I'm thinking it might be smart to see if we can hook up with one of those wagon trains passing through Council Grove. They ain't likely to suspect a wagon train like they would two wagons alone heading out into Indian territory.
Well, by God, that's just what I was thinking.
Tanner Bland had never seen the ocean, but his father had told him of a trip to the Carolina coast when he was a young man. His father had said that it was a sight that confused his mind. There was no end to it, stretching from horizon to horizon and constantly rolling like there was some great discomfort in its belly. Gazing out upon the seemingly endless expanse of tall grass prairie on this summer day, Tanner was reminded of his father's description of the sea. From horizon to horizon, the panorama stretched endlessly before them. The steady breeze combed the long stems of grass, causing a swaying much like he imagined the ocean might exhibit. Here and there, wildflowers sprinkled the prairie with vivid colors, making it appear docile and friendly, welcoming the two travelers. With Jeb as the guide, they left Mound City behind them, heading for Council Grove, a town on the Neosho River. According to Jeb, it had long been a favorite rendezvous spot for travelers on the Santa Fe Trail, with plenty of good water and grass and wood from the groves of hardwood trees. Council Grove was also a favorite river crossing for the long wagon trains that traveled to Santa Fe because of the Neosho's natural rock bed river bottom. It was a meeting place for all manner of travelers, not just wagon trains. Gold seekers on their way to California often passed through, as well as army supply wagons on their way to southwestern forts. This seemingly endless parade of pilgrims was witnessed with more than a little interest by Ka Indians settled close by. It was close to evening when the two travelers walked their horses past the stage company's corral.
There's been talk that the stage is going to move out of Council Grove and go over to Junction City. I doubt there's anything to it. Hell, folks been coming through here for about 40 years. That over there is Malcolm Kahn's store. That's where we'll get our supplies tomorrow.
Then he pointed to a building farther down the street.
There is Hayes' house. I'm going to buy you as fine a supper as you'll find anywhere right there. Courtesy of the Union Army.
Maybe you best hold on to that money. It's a long way to Montana.
Don't worry. I aim to use this money for a grub steak. But we ain't got much for supper tonight, and anyway, we deserve one good meal before we start out on bacon and beans.
It's your money.
It's our money, partner.
The early evening crowd had thinned out somewhat by the time Jeb and Tanner walked into Brandon's saloon after having their supper at the Hayes house. They walked up to the bartender.
Brandon's? The place has changed names, ain't it?
How long's it been since you was here? It's changed names two or three times in the last 2 years. I own it now. My name's John Brannan.
Well, Mr. Brannan, pour us a couple of shots of your best. Me and my partner are heading for Montana in the morning, and this might be the last drink we have for a spell. Hell, might as well leave us the bottle.
There were only four tables in the saloon, and only one of them occupied. Grabbing the bottle by the neck, Jeb moved to a table close to the door. Feeling himself a guest of his partner's generosity, Tanner followed.
Am I going to have to haul you out of bed in the morning, tote you to Montana on a pack horse?
Old steady Tanner. Don't worry. Hell, there ain't that much left in this bottle. We'll just finish it off and then we'll go to bed.
Just as Jeb had promised, the two partners sat enjoying an evening drink with no distractions other than an occasional outburst of laughter from the other table where three men were playing cards. It appeared to be a friendly game between locals who knew each other. After about a half an hour, the door to the back room opened and a woman entered the bar room. She paused to exchange some brief conversation with the three men at the back table before moving on to Tanner and Jeb.
Evening, gents. You fellas ain't been in before, have you?
She was not a pretty woman, probably well into her 30s, her pale face already etched with hardship lines, but she was female. Consequently, she had the qualifications necessary to ignite that perpetual glow that burned inside the core of Jeb Hawkins.
Well, good evening to you, ma'am. You're right. We ain't been in here before. But if we'd known about you, we'd have sure been in here sooner.
I'm Myra Brannan. My husband is the owner.
Oh, I'm pleased to meet you, Myra. My name's Jeb. This is my partner, Tanner.
Tanner nodded when she released her gaze from Jeb for a brief moment before returning it to him.
So you're the bartender's wife. He's a big feller, ain't he?
Yes, and he's got a jealous streak a mile wide.
Well, I can see why. If I was married to a fine-looking woman like you, I'd most likely keep her locked up.
By this time, the conversation between his wife and the young stranger had captured the attention of John Brannan. Tanner glanced over toward the bar and noticed the big man's dark frown as he stared in their direction. Marveling at Jeb's infatuation with all things female, Tanner was just about to caution him of the husband's interest when Myra ended the flirtation.
Well, it was nice to meet you fellas. I got some things to take care of out back.
With that, she turned and left through the same door she'd come in. And barely 5 minutes passed before Jeb stood up from the table.
Well, I gotta empty the old bladder. I'll be back in a minute.
He went to the bar where a scowling John Brannan awaited.
I might as well go ahead and pay you for that bottle. I don't suppose you got an outhouse out back, do you?
Not for customers, I don't.
Oh, I expect I'll have to use the alley then.
Out the front door, Jeb went. Brannan was undecided. He waited for a while, polishing some whiskey glasses, the scowl in place while he watched the door, shifting his gaze occasionally toward Tanner, who was still seated at the table. Finally, when too much time had passed with no sign of the brash young stranger, Brannan dropped his towel on the counter, pulled his shotgun from under it, and went out the door. There was no one in the alley next to the saloon. Brannan paused to look up and down the dark passageway for a few seconds. Knowing with certainty whose laughter it was, he ran toward the back of the building. Rounding the corner, he came upon the very thing he'd suspected. There on the back step of the saloon, he found his wife leaning casually against the door frame, grinning girlishly at something the stranger had just said.
By God! I thought so, you son of a bitch! You don't pussyfoot around my wife and get away with it.
Whoa! Wait a minute!
John, he didn't do nothing. He just thought he could get back in the bar this way.
Brannan hesitated, but only for a moment.
You best put it down.
John felt the light tap of a rifle barrel on the back of his head. He froze.
Just a little misunderstanding. We apologize if there was any offense to you or your wife. Ease those hammers back down, and we'll be on our way. No harm done.
He's right, John. No harm done. Just a misunderstanding.
Yeah, all right. But I don't want to see the likes of you two around my place again.
You won't. Come on, Jeb.
Without wasting another word, they turned and walked up the alley, leaving the bartender and his wife to work out their differences.
I knew you'd watch my back.
One of these days, I might not be there. What the hell you want to go after that woman for?
Hell, she wasn't that bad. Besides, she had a kind of sad look about her. I figured she needed a little attention.
They passed up the hotel, preferring to bed down in the stable with their horses. Tanner awakened in the middle of the night to find Jeb missing. He awakened again hours later when Jeb returned.
Took you a long time to piss.
I knew she needed some attention. She wasn't getting what she needed. I'm glad I could help her out. That husband of hers is a hell of a heavy sleeper, though.
Tanner shook his head, hardly believing, then turned over and went back to sleep. Bright and early the next morning, none of the worse for wear after their visit to the saloon, they spent some of Jeb's money for a pack horse to carry the supplies that were later purchased at Khan's store. Ready to bid Council Grove farewell then, they loped out of town following the Santa Fe Trail. Although it had been their original intention to set out straight to the northwest, on the advice of Malcolm Khan, they changed their plans. There were numerous reports of hostile Indian activity along the old Oregon Trail to the north, so it made better sense to follow the Santa Fe, at least to Fort Larned, then head north. That way, they could get information on the hostile situation beyond that point. Neither of the two had any real experience with Indians, but they agreed that if Santa Fe was the safer route, why not take advantage of it for part of their journey? As near as they could estimate, Fort Larned was 150 miles or more from Council Grove, and they held to the Santa Fe Trail, even though it bothered them that it seemed to lead them further south than they cared to go. After traveling 3 days and figuring they had only one full day's ride before reaching the fort, they came to the point where the Walnut River joined the Arkansas and discovered a wagon train camp there. Jacob Freeman walked to the edge of the circle of wagons and with 1 foot propped on a wagon tongue, watched the two riders and a pack horse. As the leader of the train, he was keenly interested in strangers approaching his company as settlers bound for the Northwest, whether they be Indians or white drifters. In the twilight of the evening, it was difficult to determine the nature of the two men until they had come within a few dozen yards.
Well, they ain't Injuns.
Floyd Reese was standing by his wagon, equally interested in the identity of the visitors.
Watch 'em just the same, Jacob.
Hello, the camp!
Although cautious, since his train was made up of peaceful Christian folk, Jacob was bound to be charitable by nature.
Welcome, gentlemen. You're welcome to come on in and rest a spell. You're a mite late for supper, but my missus might scare up some coffee.
We're obliged, but we won't put you out any. We can camp down the river a ways.
Why, no need to do that. There's plenty of room here, and we've already got fires going. We'd be glad to have your company.
Floyd Reese cocked an eye at him.
Oh, it's a Christian thing to do. And anyway, I'd rather have them where we can keep an eye on them.
Only 30 miles short of Fort Larned, Jacob didn't like the thought of two strange men lurking around the fringes of his camp. Jeb looked at Tanner, and Tanner shrugged.
That's mighty neighborly of you. I reckon we'll take you up on it.
They dismounted and led their horses within the circle of wagons. The rest of the people in the train gathered to greet their guests. The men in frank appraisal, the women hanging back initially, and the children pressing closer to get a better look.
I'm Jacob Freeman.
I'm Jeb Hawkins. This here's my partner, Tanner Bland. Where are you folks headed? Santa Fe?
No, sir. We're planning to stay with the trail along the Arkansas into Colorado, to Bent's Fort. Then we're set on turning north to strike the South Platte and Fort Laramie. California's our destination.
How about you fellers? Where are you heading?
Montana. Lord, and the engine's willing.
I expect we best unsaddle these horses and water them.
You can just turn them with our stock after you water them. Plenty of good grass here. Best we've seen at a campsite the past week.
Much obliged.
After the horses were taken care of, Tanner and Jeb set up their camp. They spread their bedrolls next to their saddles, under the watchful eyes of the members of the wagon train. And they were in the process of preparing to fry some bacon for their dinner when Ida Freeman sauntered up with a coffee pot in hand.
There's a little left in the pot if you'd like some coffee. Sorry there's no beans left.
Why, thank you, ma'am, but we got food for ourselves.
Ida's offer of hospitality seemed to be the spark that dissolved the cloud of caution that hovered over the two strangers, and many of the others promptly crowded around to extend greetings of welcome. Within minutes, the two guests felt right at home, exchanging news and answering questions. While Jeb made the most of the conversation from their side, Tanner watched in silent amusement at his partner's gift of small talk. By the time they finished their supper, they were practically old friends of the people of the train, thanks to Jeb's natural gregarious personality. Those who had not as yet learned the stranger's names referred to him as the talker and the silent one. Always with an eye for the women, Jeb fixed his gaze on a slender, dark-haired girl who inched up close to the fire to listen to the gossip swapped back and forth between Jacob and Jeb. Her name was Cora Abbott Leach. She wasn't there long before Jeb made it a point to personally introduce himself.
Howdy, miss. My name's Jeb Hawkins. I'm pleased to make your acquaintance.
It's Mrs.
Joe Leach moved up behind Cora. He placed his hand firmly on her shoulder.
I'm her husband.
Well, then my compliments to you, sir. Looks to me like you married over your head.
Deep-set eyes that glowered out from under heavy eyebrows glared unblinking at the outspoken stranger for a few long seconds as Leach's hand clamped down harder on his wife's shoulder.
Get yourself back to the wagon.
Studying the sympathetic faces, Tanner surmised that Cora's rough treatment was not unusual. He felt sorry for the woman. Leach looked like a hard-handed brute. and he was still smoldering as he continued to glare at Jeb. Of more than casual interest were the three men who stood close behind Leach. All seemed cut from the same rough stock as the young woman's husband, and hardly fit in with the rest of the wagon train company. Tanner guessed that they might be brothers, and he saw that the glint in their eyes as they stared at Jeb was far from cordial. Glancing around at the faces in the gathering, Tanner noted that Jeb was the only person smiling over his attempt to make a joke. Knowing his partner by now, Tanner was certain that Jeb would not intentionally shine up to a married woman unless he thought she craved the attention. He hoped that Jeb hadn't caused any trouble for her. As for Jeb, well, he blithely ignored Leach's threatening gaze. Already having shifted his interest towards seeking out other likely-looking prospects in the gathering. After a brief period, Leach turned and followed his wife to his wagon. The three other sullen men followed him. Tanner noticed an immediate relaxation in the crowd's mood, as if a dark cloud had drifted from overhead. As the evening wore on, the people dispersed. Morning came early on a wagon train, and most of the folks had already stayed up late to visit with the two guests. Two of the last to leave were Jacob Freeman and Floyd Reitz.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I expect I might be. Them two might be the Lord's way of solving our little problem. Might be too much of a coincidence otherwise.
Less than a week before, the wagon train had met with an army patrol out of Fort Larned. The lieutenant commanding the patrol informed them of a new requirement set by the government because of increased hostile activity between Fort Larned and Fort Lyon in Colorado. There were new restrictions on wagon trains that traveled beyond Fort Larned, since the post didn't have the manpower to escort every group of settlers that came through. Each train was required to have at least 20 wagons and 30 men. For the last few days, Jacob and Floyd had talked over the problem. They had 22 wagons, but only 28 men, including the four Leach brothers. They had almost decided to bypass Fort Larned in order not to be detained. It did indeed seem a stroke of luck, if not a favor from God, that the two young strangers showed up just before the wagon train reached Fort Larned. Jacob and Floyd were agreed. The proposition was offered to Tanner and Jeb the following morning as the camp was breaking up for the day's journey.
We'd be much obliged if you fellas would consider it. We don't expect to be at Fort Larned for more than a day or two. We've got a few folks that need some blacksmith work and some wagon repairs. Then we're for moving right along. All we need from you is to count you as part of our company, just to satisfy the new rule.
What do you say, Tanner? I don't reckon a day or two will make much difference to us. And if we can help these folks get on their way...
I suppose it couldn't hurt us to hang back for a day or two. You folks can stand us.
Tanner figured that he and Jeb alone could make Fort Larned in one more day's ride. Tagging along with the wagon train would change that to 2 days, but he felt in no particular hurry.
Fine. We appreciate it.
Jacob and Floyd exchanged nods, satisfied that one problem had been solved.
You fellas are welcome to camp by my wagon tonight if you like. My wife might even make up some pan biscuits to go with your supper.
I surely wouldn't turn that down. I ain't had a good biscuit in I don't know when. Tanner there ain't made me no biscuits since we partnered up.
After the day's travel, the wagon train made a camp by a narrow creek with steep banks where it emptied into the Arkansas. As promised, Ida Freeman broke out her big iron skillet and worked up dough for a large batch of pan biscuits. Tanner, a hunter since he was a small boy, decided to take the pack horse and ride off across the prairie in search of meat. With the slow pace of travel, there had been ample opportunity to scout away from the wagons, and he had discovered evidence of abundant game along the way.
Want me to go with you?
Tanner was just getting ready to leave. It was plain to see that Jeb was already in the process of unsaddling his horse and looking forward to socializing with the wagon company.
No, I reckon not. I'm just gonna ride out a ways and see if I get a shot.
All right, then. You watch yourself, Tanner. There's engines about these parts.
Jeb dropped his saddle beside Jacob's wagon. Then, seeing Ida Freeman getting a bucket from the wagon, he stepped up to offer his help.
Here, ma'am. Let me fetch that water for you.
Why, thank you, sir.
Ida handed the bucket to Jeb. She brushed away a stray strand of graying hair from her forehead and gave the cheerful young man a long looking over. She decided that she liked him. He seemed as carefree and fun-loving as his partner was serious and soft-spoken. The two men were a decided contrast in personality. She turned then when her husband returned from the creek bank with an armload of wood for a fire. Jeb arrived at the creek just as a woman started to make her way down to the water. He recognized her as the pretty young girl he had spoken to the night before and had been abruptly informed that she was married. Upon seeing him approaching, Cora Leach ducked her head to avoid his gaze. Jeb didn't speak, but seconds later he moved quickly to catch her arm when her foot slid on the steep bank and she was about to fall.
Careful there, Missy. I wouldn't want a pretty young lady like yourself to go head over heels into that creek.
Looking embarrassed and frightened, Cora regained her balance and was quick to remove her elbow from Jeb's grasp.
Thank you.
Jeb noticed a fairly fresh bruise beside her right eye and almost commented on it, but decided to hold his tongue instead.
Here, why don't you let me fill that bucket for you?
No, thank you, sir, but I can get it.
No trouble at all. I gotta fill this one anyway. It'll be easier to fill both of them. Keep my balance better with two coming up this bank.
Jeb descended the bank before she could protest further. A moment later, he returned with the two full buckets.
I'd be glad to carry it back for you.
Oh, no, no. I'll get in trouble.
Cora!
Jeb turned toward the boys. It was not Cora's husband. Standing near the closest wagon, one of the three men who had backed Cora's husband the night before glared menacingly at the frightened girl. She grabbed the bucket, almost spilling it, and hurried back toward the camp. As Jeb watched, she hung her head when she passed by the man. Jeb couldn't hear the words spoken, but she was obviously scolded as she went by him.
Well, damn.
Aware that the man was still standing there, now glaring at him, Jeb turned and started back to camp with his bucket of water. Standing beside her wagon, Ida Freedman paused in her supper preparations when she saw the incident taking place by the creek bank. Though it was a minor thing and seemingly of little significance, she deemed it important to warn Jeb about paying any attention to Cora Leach.
Here you go, ma'am.
I thank you, sir.
No trouble at all. Always glad to help a fine-looking woman, especially one that makes such fine biscuits.
Oh, don't go wasting your charm on me. Young man, it appears to me that you're possessed of a fun-loving spirit, and I reckon that's your business. But I need to warn you about having any to-do with the Leach brothers, especially Garth. That's the big fella that was just down the creek when you were talking to Cora. Garth's the oldest of the four brothers, and Jacob can tell you that he's the most dangerous of the bunch, although they're all pretty ornery.
The warning surprised Jeb, causing him to give her a questioning look. Jacob walked up.
Ida's right. Them boys is bad business, and no doubt about it.
Why, I ain't looking to cause anybody trouble, Jacob. All I did was get a bucket of water for the lady, same as I did for you.
They joined up with us back at Council Grove. Two wagons, Joe and Cora in one, and Garth, Ike, and Jesse in the other. We found out about 2 days out of Council Grove that we'd made a mistake in letting them join us. They just ain't our kind of folks.
Fighting and cussing. Whew. You never heard such a fuss. We were kind of hoping they'd kill each other off after we saw what kind of people they were. The thing that bothers me most is the way they treat that poor little girl Joe's married to. I swear, she comes out with a new bruise or cut every morning. Janie Reese asked her what happened to her eye one morning, and that weasel she's married to told Janie to mind her own business.
Well, there's that, but there's also the fact that the wagon three of the brothers are driving is loaded down with something. Fred Lister got a peek into that wagon one day when he was looking for his son. The little fella's about 3 years old, and he'd run off somewhere. Fred was just looking to keep the young'un from pestering anybody, but he got told pretty quick to keep his nose out of their wagons. Fred said he didn't get to see much, but there were some wood crates that looked like the kind rifles are shipped in, and he saw one whiskey barrel. Everything else was covered up. They're up to no good, that bunch. They tagged on to us for protection, and I reckon they figure the soldiers won't bother looking in their wagons as long as they're traveling with respectable folks like us.
Why don't you tell them to quit the train?
We intend to, but up to now, we haven't. For the same reason we asked you and your partner to join up. We'll wait till we get clear of Fort Larned. Then, by thunder, we'll come to a partner the ways quick enough.
Well, any trouble they get from me, they'll bring it on themselves. When the time comes, me and Tanner will back you.
I appreciate it. I'm afraid they ain't gonna like it when I tell them to get.
It was close to sundown when Tanner returned to camp with two antelope carcasses tied on his pack horse. He was a welcome sight, since he offered to share the meat with the entire train, and several of the men quickly volunteered to help him butcher the animals. The arrival of fresh meat served to spawn a festive air about the camp, and soon the cook fires were rekindled and burning brightly. Jacob Freeman announced it a cause for celebration on the eve of reaching Fort Larned.
We can make the fort with our bellies full of fresh meat instead of salt pork.
Off to one side of the circle of wagons, the four Leach brothers stood watching, sullen and scornful. They stared at the festive scene like coyotes on the fringe of a buffalo herd. Only Cora sneaked a hint of a smile as she watched the children darting close to the fire to snatch a sliver of roasted meat. Noticing the longing gaze of the dark-eyed girl, Ida Friedman walked over to her.
Don't hang back there in the shadows, honey. Come on over here to the fire and join us.
Cora looked quickly at her husband, seeking permission. She was met with a deep frown.
We already ate our supper. Cora don't need no wild meat.
We don't see enough of you, young lady. Why don't you come join the fun?
I done told you.
No, thank you, Miss Freeman. I still got chores to do before bedtime. But thank you just the same.
Ida shook her head slowly as she read the sadness in the young girl's eyes. Then she glared at Joe for a second before turning on her heel. Cora felt the iron grip of her husband's hand on her shoulder again.
Get yourself back to the wagon.
With no word of protest, she turned and obeyed, walking back to the wagon without a backward glance at the cheerful celebration. Close by Jacob's campfire, Jeb stood watching the incident between Ida Friedman and Joe Leach. At some 30 yards away, he could barely make out a word or two of the conversation, but just enough to determine the gist of it. He said nothing for a few moments, thinking of the fresh bruise on Cora's face.
That ain't no way to treat a woman.
Tanner turned to see what had caused the comment. Following Jeb's gaze, he immediately saw the reason.
I reckon there's a lot of men that don't deserve a wife. Don't seem right, but I guess it's between the two of them and none of our business.
Just the same, I hate to see a woman treated like that.
I know. Maybe she doesn't think it's that bad. She would have run off and left him.
Maybe. Unless she's too scared of him to run.
In an attempt to take his partner's mind off of the unfortunate girl, Tanner sliced off a generous slab of haunch and handed it to Jeb.
Try this. It's pretty good eating. As fast as these critters run, I'm surprised the meat ain't tough as nails. I've hunted all kinds of game, but I ain't ever seen anything move as fast as antelope. A man has to time his shot just right, because there ain't a chance for a second shot.
Jib reluctantly pulled his concentration away from the slight young woman.